You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight you're going to get an awful lot of information, so I hope you're prepared to write a pen and paper by your side. I'm going to be throwing at you like crazy. You're going to hear some blasts from the past, something that those of you of the older generation in our audience might remember, and the rest of you certainly will not, and need to know. You need to hear some of these things, and you need to know what's really happening, how it's happening, and why. So what I'm going to be doing is imparting some information from the Perestroika Deception by Anatoly Golitsyn, who was a high-ranking defector from the Soviet Union. He wrote a book many years ago entitled New Lies for Old. I first heard about Anatoly Golitsyn when I was a member of the United States Navy on the intelligence briefing team for the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet, and managed to read quite a few of the analysis of the debriefings of Anatoly Golitsyn by the Central Intelligence Agency, outlining what he said was the long-range plan of the Soviet Union to disarm and conquer the West. I believe you're going to find tonight's broadcast extremely interesting. That is, if you care at all about the future, if you care about liberty, and if you care about freedom. So, ladies and gentlemen, please pay attention. Anatoly Golitsyn was born in the Ukraine in 1926. While he was a cadet in military school, he was awarded a Soviet medal for the defense of Moscow in the Great Patriotic War, for digging anti-tank trenches near Moscow. At the age of 15, he joined the Komsomol, which is the League of Communist Youth, and at 19, he became a member of the Communist Party. In the same year, he joined the KGB, in which he studied and served until 1961. He graduated from the Moscow School of Military Counter-Espionage, the counterintelligence faculty of the High Intelligence School and the University of Marxist-Leninism, and completed a correspondence course with the High Diplomatic School. In 1952 and early 1953, he was involved with a friend in drawing up a proposal to the Central Committee on the Reorganization of Soviet Intelligence. In connection with this proposal, he attended a meeting of the Secretariat chaired by Stalin, and a meeting of the Presidium chaired by Malenkov, and attended by Khrushchev, Brezhnev, and Bulganin. In 1952 and 53, he worked briefly as head of a section responsible for counter-espionage against the United States. In 1959, he graduated with a law degree from a four-year course at the KGB Institute, now the KGB Academy, in Moscow. From 1959 to 1960, at a time when Soviet long-range strategy was being formulated and the KGB was being reorganized to play its part in it, he served as a senior analyst in the NATO section of the Information Department of the Soviet Intelligence Service. He served in Vienna and Helsinki on counterintelligence assignments from 1953 to 1955 and from 1960 to 1961, respectively. Anatoly Golitsyn defected to the United States in December of 1961. Subsequently, his contribution to the national security of leading Western countries was recognized by the award of the United States Government Medal for Distinguished Service. He was made an honorary commander of the British Empire, CBE, a promise of membership of the Legion d'Honor made when President Pompidou was in power was not fulfilled owing to the change of government. Since 1962, Anatoly Golitsyn has spent much of his time on the study of communist and international affairs, reading both the Communist and the Western Press. In 1980, he completed, and in 1984, he published New Lies for Old, a study of the Soviet long-range strategy of deception and disinformation. For over 30 years, Anatoly Golitsyn has submitted memoranda to the Central Intelligence Agency in which he has provided the agency with timely and largely accurate forecasts of Soviet bloc developments and on the evolution of Soviet-Russian communist strategy. By applying the dialectical methodology which drives the strategy, Anatoly Golitsyn has been able to score innumerable bullseyes. This unparalleled track record reflects his personal experience of 4 years in the KGB's strategy think tank, together with his deep understanding of the dialectical nature of the strategy and the Leninist mentality of its originators and implementers. Anatoly Golitsyn is now a citizen of the United States of America. It was not in 1985, ladies and gentlemen, but in 1958 that the communist leaders recognized, after the Hungarian and Polish revolts, that the Stalinist practice of mass repression had severely damaged the system, and that radical measures were necessary to restore it. It was then that they decided to transform the Stalinist system into a more attractive form of communist democracy. It was not in 1985, but in 1958, that the communist leaders accepted that their economic system was ineffective and lagging behind the West in productivity. It was then that they decided that it would have to be revived through the introduction of market incentives. It was then that the communist leaders realized that communism could not be spread abroad against a background of fear and mass repression, and that world communist victory could only be achieved by transforming the Soviet and other communist regimes into a form more attractive to the West. It was during 1958 to 1960 that the communist leaders envisaged the convergence of restructured and transformed capitalist systems, leading ultimately to one system of world government. World government. Taking account of the military strength of NATO, the communist leaders decided to build up their military strength as a guarantee of the success of their program of domestic reform and as a pressure weapon for disarmament negotiations with the West and the execution of their strategy of convergence. Accepting the necessity for stability in the political leadership of the USSR for the execution of the long-range strategy, the Soviet leaders rejected Stalin's practice of eliminating his rivals and reverted to Lenin's style of leadership. They solved the problem through the selection by the Central Committee of Nikita Khrushchev's successor in advance of Khrushchev's own retirement. Leonid Brezhnev had already been chosen in this way in July of 1960 when he was made president and was given a special briefing by the chairman of the KGB in preparation for the new responsibilities he would be assuming when Khrushchev stepped down. A common commitment to the long-range strategy itself became a factor in the prevention of further power struggles. Western experts failed to understand this because Khrushchev's retirement was deliberately misrepresented by the Soviet leaders to the West as his dismissal. In this and in other ways, the origin of the long-range deception strategy of perestroika was successfully concealed. Under the guidance of the party apparatus, special research studies were initiated and carried out from September 1957 onwards by the Soviet Academy of Sciences in preparation for the strategy. The party apparatus and its think tanks, the Higher Party School, and the Academy of Social Sciences employed the results of this research in seeking scientific and theoretical solutions to the primary domestic problems associated with the strategy. It was these think tanks which developed the scenarios for Soviet reforms and trained Soviet and bloc party leaders such as Dubček in the spirit and demands of the strategy. The KGB Institute and its research department conducted a number of special studies for the Central Committee. Among them were studies on new methods of neutralizing political opposition in the Soviet Union and disclosure of state secrets in the interest of strategy, which has an obvious connection with the present openness, or glasnost, one feature of which is the disclosure of quantities of accurate information together with quantities of disinformation. Special studies of the economies and international relations of the leading capitalist countries were conducted by the Institute of World Economy and International Relations. The Institute paid close attention to the European common market and to clashes of economic interest between the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. the appointment of the director of this institute as a chief economic advisor to Gorbachev can be explained by the contribution made by the institute to the strategy of perestroika. A special research organ, the Institute for the Study of the USA and Canada, was set up in 1960 in Moscow to meet the demands of the strategy. For almost the whole period of the strategy, the institute, led by academician Georgiy Arbatov, has studied in depth every major political, social, cultural, and racial problem in the United States. The institute keeps a close watch on the workings of the executive, Congress, the press, political parties, and the more important religious organizations. Arbatov and his subordinates have established close relations with the American elite, cultivating many leading politicians, scientists, religious leaders, experts in Soviet affairs, journalists, and cultural figures through meetings in Washington and invitations to visit the Soviet Union. Soviet American student exchanges have been used to study the workings of American institutions and to train Soviet experts in areas which have a bearing on the execution of the strategy. You may remember that William Jefferson Clinton was one of those chosen for the Soviet American student exchange program. For instance, Alexander Yakovlev, Gorbachev's key advisor on international policy and the promotion of perestroika in the American media, studied the media at Columbia University on an exchange program. The Soviet embassy in Washington has played a special role in studying the inner workings of American policy formulation and providing advice to Soviet strategists. A significant novelty was introduced into the work of the Soviet ambassador to the United States. In the interests of the strategy, Ambassador Anatoly Dubrynin was made chief KGB resident in Washington in order that the diplomatic work of the embassy could be fully coordinated with the exploitation of the assets of the KGB residentura, especially its important agents of influence among politicians, businessmen, scientists, and, of course, Western journalists. Anatoly Golitsyn prepared a special memorandum on Anatoly Dobrynin for the CIA, which confirmed Dobrynin's use of KGB agents along strategic lines. The late Mr. James Angleton concluded that the memorandum should be published in declassified form in order to neutralize Dobrynin's political influence in Washington and have him expelled for interference in the internal affairs of the United States. The findings of the memorandum were, however, disregarded after the Watergate hearings, which destabilized the American intelligence and counterintelligence services. In accordance with a party decision, the KGB was assigned a key role in the execution of the strategy. In 1959, the KGB, under Alexander Shalepin, was instructed to employ its intelligence and security assets, not for mass repression, but in the interests of strategy against the main enemy. Its main task became the neutralization and dissolution of genuine political opposition by nationalists and anti-Soviet intellectuals. Let me read that again to you. Its main task became the neutralization and dissolution of genuine political opposition by nationalists and anti-Soviet intellectuals. The KGB was ordered to create controlled political opposition and to introduce it to Western intelligence services along the lines of Dzerzhinsky's trust. As this Mr. Golitsyn revealed in the early 1960s, the KGB began the creation of a controlled dissident movement with a skillful, controlled dispute between liberal writers like Alexander Vardovsky, Yevgeny Yevtushenko, and Nikolai Voznesensky, and conservatives like Sevolod Kochetov, the KGB recruited and developed important agents of influence, allied with the dissidents among leading Soviet scientists like Andrei Sakharov and Peter Kapitsa. It was no accident that modern dissident prisoners at this time were allowed by the KGB to become visible and famous and to be monitored by human rights groups in the West, unlike the totally isolated and unheard of inmates of Stalin's prisons who simply perished without trace. It is important to note that famous dissidents achieved a high public profile before the advent of glasnost, or openness. The task of agents of influence, like the late Andrei Sakharov, is not a propaganda one. It is to act as assistants in the execution of the strategy of Soviet reform and convergence with the West. The KGB further recruited a number of theater and movie directors, writers and journalists, and unofficially encouraged them to experiment with formerly taboo and controversial subjects like repression, prison life, rehabilitation, and questions of conscience and religion. The object of these experiments was to prepare these chosen individuals for the role of initiators and catalysts in the forthcoming controlled liberalization of the Soviet regime. The KGB reoriented its old agents among Soviet religious leaders, the KGB's Gapons, and used their influence to help convergence with the Western churches. Convergence with the Western churches. The KGB benefited from the experience of exploiting religious leaders under Stalin in the Second World War, and in the 1960s they employed that experience on a larger scale and with greater sophistication. The KGB, the party, the press, and even the courts have been used for the calculated public exposure of dissidents and their activities in the West as examples for the education and re-education of Western anti-Soviet intellectuals. On the initiative of the KGB, an army of Soviet vigilantes 5 million strong, the so-called Druzhiny, was recruited from among the Komsomol activists. Their units were led by retired Czechists. They have been patrolling and policing the streets of all the Soviet cities. Their primary task has been to prepare the Soviet people to behave during the forthcoming liberalization of perestroika. Soviet psychiatry and the incarceration of active anti-communists in psychiatric hospitals have been used to educate and intimidate the population into further submission to the regime by demonstrating that only the mentally abnormal protest against it. The party has also used détente with the West as a weapon against Soviet anti-communists, arguing that anti-communism in the Soviet Union is hopeless because even the West accepts the Soviet system. The communist press obtained maximum mileage from the American failure to help the Czechoslovaks when their party-controlled democratization, in fact, ran out of control in 1968. This had a sobering effect on genuine anti-communists in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. Furthermore, for the purpose of dissolving genuine opposition, the KGB facilitated the selective immigration of individuals who were hostile to the system or who wished to join relatives abroad. All these KGB and party methods, together with the natural aging and death of Stalin's former victims, resulted in the disappearance of active anti-communists and the general acceptance of the regime by the Soviet population. By the 1980s, there were no social democrats are politically active nationalists left alive in the Soviet Union. By then, the KGB and the party apparatus had succeeded in creating conditions in which only they could form strong grassroots organizations. Just as I've been telling you for years, and they're doing it here in the United States today. The KGB and the party conducted their preparations for perestroika in close cooperation with the parties and security services of the other communist countries. The successful preparation for perestroika by the KGB and the ministries of the interior of the Georgian and other national republics of the USSR explains the promotion of their heads, Alexander Shalepin, Yuri Andropov, Gaider Aliyev, Eduard Shevardnadze, Viktor Shebrikov, and Andrei Vlasov to the Politburo and other key strategic positions. Since 1959, the Communist Bloc parties and governments have been involved in political, practical experiments and rehearsals for separate elements of perestroika in different countries in preparation for its introduction overall. The most important of these experiments and rehearsals were an attempt at liberalization in the early 1960s under Khrushchev, publication of an article about market economics by Professor Yevsei Lieberman and experiments with firms and trusts in 1962, Alexei Kosygin's economic reforms in 1965, alleged Romanian independence from the early 1960s onwards, the Cultural Revolution in China, in fact, a campaign of ideological and political re-education and a preparation of the inexperienced and inept Chinese party bureaucracy for détente with the capitalist West. Democratization in Czechoslovakia in 1968, legislation by the Polish Communist Party of Solidarity in 1980, and the introduction of capitalist incentives in China and Hungary during the 1970s and the 1980s. The Soviet strategist studied the performance, outcome, lessons, and mistakes of these experiments and rehearsals. No doubt, they drew proper practical conclusions from the excesses of the Cultural Revolution in China and the loss of control over the experiments with democratization in Czechoslovakia and solidarity in Poland. They probably also drew conclusions from the painful experiences of Yugoslavia. The experience gained was of enormous benefit for influencing the introduction of perestroika in all its elements, in their totality, in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, known to most of you as the Soviet Union. The development and execution of the strategy over a 30-year period has strengthened Soviet power militarily, politically, and with Western help, economically. Anatoly Golitsyn strongly disagreed with Brzezinski's assessment that the USSR is collapsing. The execution of the strategy has broadened the political base of the Communist Party in the Russian and the other national republics. Careful preparation has created the conditions for overall perestroika and the transition of the regime in the most powerful and experienced of the socialist countries to a phase of communist democracy. Naturally, the Soviet leaders seek to avoid alerting the West to what is happening by describing the process in these terms. From the time the strategy was adopted, the party leadership made it clear to its technocrats, bureaucrats, military, and intellectuals that the requirements of the strategy are paramount for their activities and the assessment of their performance. Because of these demands and party discipline, there can be no genuine opposition among conservatives in the party, the military, or the technocracy. Bold experiments and successful execution of the strategy in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and Communist China have given party leaders, KGB officials, generals, technocrats, and leading intellectuals a political maturity and sophistication which they have revealed in perestroika. Because of their longer historical experience, their greater political, economic, and military potential, and their thorough preparation, the communist strategists and the ruling elite are confident that they can guide and lead their people without the loss of control which occurred in Czechoslovakia in 1968 and in Poland in 1981. However, in the event of control nonetheless being endangered in given contexts, the situation will be retrieved in the usual manner, simply by means of military repression.
Мы врагов не сможем достать. Нас the call of ship dog, Smith-Dragon, Smith-Dragon. Oh, the dinner-lick-a-rot, my boiling-a-rot, Smith-Dragon, Smith-Dragon.
The new method sees perestroika not as a surprising and spontaneous change, but as the logical result of 30 years of preparation and as the next and final phase of the strategy. It sees in a broader context than Soviet openness has revealed. It sees it not only as a renewal of Soviet society, but as a global strategic design for restructuring the entire capitalist world. The following strategic objectives of perestroika may be distinguished. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, Anatoly Golitsyn disclosed this plan as early as 1961, December to be exact. For the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. A. Restructuring and revitalization of the Soviet socialist economy through the incorporation of some elements of the market economy. B. Restructuring of the Stalinist regime into a form of communist democracy with an appearance of political pluralism, or democratism. Democratization, I should say. Or democratism. C. Reconstructing a repressive regime with a brutal face into an attractive socialist model with a human facade and a seeming similarity to the Swedish social democratic system. For Eastern Europe, economic and political restructuring of the existing regimes into pseudo-social democratic models while preserving specific national historical features such as the strong Catholic socialist tradition in Poland and the pre-war democratic tradition in Czechoslovakia. For Western Europe, A. Bringing about a new political alliance between the pseudo-social democratic regimes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and the Euro-communist parties and genuine social democratic parties in Western Europe. B. Restructuring political and military blocs, NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and the creation of a single Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, incorporating a reunited neutral Germany. Are you listening? For the main United States alliances, A. Splitting the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. B. Dissolution of NATO and the United States-Japan Security Pact, and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Western Europe and Japan. For Third World countries, the introduction and promotion of a new Soviet model with a mixed economy and a human face in Latin America, Africa, and Asia through a joint campaign by the pseudo-social democrat regimes of the old Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and the genuine social democrats of Western Europe, led by the Socialist Internationale. For the United States, A. To neutralize the influence of the anti-communist political right in the American political parties, and to create favorable conditions for a victory of the radical left in the 1992 United States presidential elections. And if you've been paying attention, ladies and gentlemen, they certainly accomplished that. B. To restructure the American military, political, economic, and social status quo to accommodate greater convergence between the Soviet and American systems and the eventual creation of a single world government. The paramount global objective of the strategy of perestroika is to weaken and neutralize anti-communist ideology and the influence of anti-communists in political life in the United States, Western Europe, and elsewhere, presenting them as anachronistic survivors of the Cold War, reactionaries, and obstacles to restructuring and peace. Anyone who warns about Moscow's true objectives is automatically branded a Cold Warrior, even by people who have doubts about Moscow's motives. The new method penetrates the facade, tears the verbal mask off perestroika, and reveals its true meaning, which Gorbachev and Glasnost have failed to do. Lenin's teaching and the experience of the new economic policy are keys to understanding the essence of perestroika and the reasons for Gorbachev's downgrading and reunification of elements of ideological orthodoxy like the class struggle and his emphasis on common interests and the benefits of close cooperation. Lenin advised the communists that they must be prepared to resort to all sorts of stratagems, maneuvers, illegal methods, evasions, and subterfuge to achieve their objectives. This advice was given on the eve of his reintroduction of limited capitalism in Russia in his work, Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder. The new method sees perestroika as an application of Lenin's advice in new conditions. Another speech of Lenin's in the NEP period at the Comintern Congress in July 1921 is again highly relevant to understanding perestroika. "Our only strategy at present," wrote Lenin, "is to become stronger and therefore wiser, more reasonable, more opportunistic. The more opportunistic, the sooner will you again assemble the masses around you. When we have won over the masses by our reasonable approach, we shall then apply offensive tactics in the strictest sense of the word." It is obvious that Gorbachev's opportunistic speeches and his presentation of perestroika to the West are very clever applications of Lenin's thinking. Gorbachev's reasonableness and moderation are aimed at assembling and winning over the masses throughout the world, and yet another of Lenin's speeches is relevant here. Instructing the Soviet delegation to the Genoa Conference in 1921, he advised them to use moderate language in negotiations in order not to frighten the capitalists, and particularly to avoid reference to the class struggle, the violence, and the terrorist aspects of communist doctrine. Gorbachev's speech to the United Nations and Shevardnadze's pronouncements about a downgrading of the class struggle are classic applications of Lenin's thinking. The new method views the ostensible arguments about the class struggle in the Soviet Union as no more than a calculated device to win over Western policymakers and influence public opinion in favor of Gorbachev's policies. The new method also sees a close parallel between Western expectations arising out of the new economic policy and those arising, I've got to stop and take a drink of water. My tongue is getting tied to my cheek again. The new method also sees a close parallel between Western expectations arising out of the new economic policy and those arising out of perestroika. In view of this parallel, the outcome of the NEP can be instructive now. The new economic policy was presented by the Soviets and accepted by the West as a retreat from communist ideology and a decline in the power of the Soviet regime. In fact, the NEP revived the Soviet economy, stabilized Soviet power, and facilitated the creation of the Soviet Federation. Because of the NEP, the Soviets were able to broaden their ideological and political assault on the capitalist world. To sum up, the essence of perestroika is the creative application of Lenin's thinking and the experience gained through the NEP to the final battle with the capitalist world. It is a step backwards to take two steps forward. Perestroika is a Leninist strategy involving the calculated renunciation of ideological orthodoxy in order to win over the masses and to achieve strategic objectives in Europe, the United States, and the Third World. The experience of the new economic policy teaches us that contemporary Soviet pragmatism and opportunism are not lasting because they are tactical. Gorbachev is a committed Leninist who is carrying out the strategy of communist renewal as a means towards the ultimate conquest of the Western democracies. And if you don't believe it, ladies and gentlemen, I challenge you to obtain Mr. Gorbachev's book entitled Perestroika and read it very carefully.
Со всей убедительностью показывает, какое исключительное, можно сказать, решающее значение для успешного строительства социализма имеет обеспечение и постоянное укрепление руководящей роли коммунистической партии как самой передовой, ведущей, организующей и направляющей силы во всем общественном развитии при социализме. Партия, вооруженная марксистско-ленинской теорией, выражающая волю рабочего класса и всех трудящихся, это решающая сила в борьбе за социализм и коммунизм. Это вместе с тем вернейший гарант того, что в развитии социалистического общества будут наиболее полно учитываться и гармонически сочетаться интересы всех образующих его трудящихся классов и социальных слоев. Недаром враги социализма первой мишенью своих нападков избирают всегда именно коммунистическую партию. Недаром ревизионисты всех мастей, проводники буржуазного влияния в рабочем движении, неизменно стремятся разрыть ее, ослабить партию, подорвать ее организационную основу, ленинский принцип демократического централизма, проповедует ослабление партийной дисциплины. Недаром они пускают в оборот теорию в кавычках, согласно которым партии надлежит отделить себя от руководства развитием общества в области экономики, государственной жизни, культуры и так далее. Такое положение, конечно, было бы очень удобно для тех, кто мечтает повернуть развитие во всех областях вспять в направлении капитализма. Все большее значение приобретает в современных условиях такая важнейшая сторона деятельности партии, как ее идеологическая работа. Формирование мировоззрения человека, социалистического и коммунистического общества, разоблачение буржуазной идеологии. Из всего этого коммунисты Советского Союза и, мы уверены, коммунисты других братских стран делают для себя ясный вывод. Нужно всеми силами крепить единство и сплоченность партии, всемерно повышать ее руководящую роль в развитии общества, совершенствовать формы ее деятельности. Опыт борьбы и реальный учет сложившейся в мире обстановки со всей ясностью говорит также о том, что коммунистам социалистических стран жизненно необходимо высоко нести знамя социалистического интернационализма, постоянно крепить сплоченность и солидарность стран социализма. В этом одно из главных условий
President Reagan responded in two ways to the Soviet threat. At first, he revived the American economy and restored American military strength. He described the Soviet Union quite correctly as the evil empire. Although unaware of the long-range strategy, he hurt the Soviets with his rhetoric, which threatened their strategic objectives. For his accomplishments in this period, history will treat Mr. Reagan kindly. But subsequently, President Reagan became involved in a new détente with Gorbachev and went over to support for perestroika without realizing its essence and its dangers for the West. In the light of this analysis, President Reagan's embrace of Gorbachev and his proclaimed closeness to the Soviets was a grave strategic blunder, which will have far-reaching and dangerous consequences for the security of America and her allies. It has imparted a misguided direction to the foreign policies of the United States, the European allies, and Japan. It has, in fact, invited the Soviets to begin their strategy of restructuring in Europe and especially in Germany. It has given them the opportunity to begin the execution of their strategy in the United States and to engage the American and West European elite, in particular the European Social Democrats, in close cooperation over restructuring. It has generated enormous euphoria in the West and an eager willingness to provide the Soviet Union with credits and technology. West European and Japanese bankers are in frenzied competition with each other to finance restructuring. West European bankers, with encouragement from Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the West German foreign minister, are already thinking of a new Marshall Plan to finance the failing economies of Eastern Europe. New opportunities have been opened up for the Soviets to undermine and neutralize rational and healthy anti-communism and the influence of the right in the political life of the Western democracies. President Reagan's closeness to the Soviets has also sent a misleading signal to their adversaries. It allows the Soviet leaders and their Communist Party to strengthen their hold over the Soviet people and to involve them in practical perestroika in the Soviet Union. Furthermore, it allows them to achieve their main strategic objective of winning over the masses in both the communist and the capitalist worlds. President Reagan's embrace of Gorbachev and perestroika has made it difficult for the new administration to develop its own policies towards the Soviets. By stoking up public expectations and popular pressure for continuing rapprochement with the Soviets. The new method detects an active Soviet offensive to reach the American elite and to engage it in close cooperation and restructuring in the United States. This operation is evident, inter alia, from the following developments. 1. The meeting between Gorbachev, his chief American experts, Dobrynin, Ambassador Dobrynin, Yakovlev, Arbatov, Posner, and others, and selected members of the American elite present at the Soviet embassy during Gorbachev's first visit to Washington. Now, I'm sure that you've all seen Vladimir Posner on television. He is a leading member of a new jet set of Russian officials who commute between Moscow and the United States. He was born in France. He speaks perfect American English, having grown up in New York. He returned with his parents to the Soviet Union in 1952 and later became a commentator on Soviet television. He acquired a reputation as a strong supporter of perestroika in the early Gorbachev period. He reappeared in the United States ahead of the August coup and became a co-host of the Posner-Donahue show. Not many of you in the audience know that Phil Donahue has been a communist for most of his life. On the Posner-Donahue show, on which he has offered his comments and interpretations on perestroika, developments in Russia, socialism, capitalism, and life. According to his own remarks on United States television, he commutes regularly between Russia and the United States. Posner, in short, is a good example of convergence in practice. Two, the consistent and persistent campaign by the Soviet embassy in Washington to widen its contacts with American businessmen, academics, political, religious, and cultural figures in order to exploit the political changes and even the disasters in the Soviet Union for the purpose of promoting the appearance of irreversible change. Three, the active use by the KGB residentura in Washington of known agents of influence in the United States in the interests of the strategy of perestroika. Four, an increase in the number of Soviet invitations to members of the American elite to visit the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and to become involved in some kind of cooperation. The recent joint Soviet-American meeting on missiles in Cuba was a case in point, and many, many more since then. Five, the active role of Sakharov, the main KGB agent of influence in introducing perestroika to the United States. Sakharov began these activities in the 1960s. In 1967, he dispatched his well-known manifesto to the West, in which he predicted, A, the victory of the realists, economic reforms and expanding democracy in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics from 1960 to 1980. B, the victory of the left-wing reformers, their attack on the forces of racism and militarism, and changes in the structure of ownership in the United States and other capitalist countries from 1972 to 1985. C, Soviet-American cooperation over disarmament and saving the poorer half of the world, 1972 to 1990. And D, the restructuring of society and convergence of the communist and capitalist systems leading to the creation of a socialist world government, 1980 to the year 2000. The predictions disseminated by Sakharov, made when the strategy of perestroika was already in preparation, represented a deliberate projection of the essence of the strategy to members of the radical left in the West in order to orientate them on and prepare them for forthcoming developments in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. This was a strategic signal by the Soviet strategists to their potential political allies in the West, particularly to their agents of influence and Euro-communists. In the event, the time frames laid down by Sakharov proved to have been only marginally out. Sakharov's predictions concealed the fact that restructuring and convergence from the essence of the Soviet long-range strategy with its aggressive intent against Western democracy. What is, in fact, the development of Soviet strategy in action is described by Sakharov as a spontaneous process and, in his own, typically Leninist words, the most optimistic unrolling of events. From the mid-1960s to 1980, the KGB, under Brezhnev's neo-Stalinist rule, allowed Sakharov to conduct his criticism and other activities as leader of and spokesman for the dissident movement. It was Sakharov who injected the Soviet view of the human rights issue into the debate by writing to President Carter on the subject. This raises an interesting question. Why was the unreformed KGB so tolerant of Sakharov, despite his apparent criticism of Soviet actions? That tolerance is explained in terms of Sakharov's active role in the execution of Soviet strategy, operating undercover as a controlled dissident. In 1980, a few years before the advent of Gorbachev's perestroika, Sakharov was exiled to Gorky. The exile of Sakharov was a typical KGB device to build up his reputation and influence as a dissident, as opposed to an enemy of the people in the West. When the unbelievable duly happened and Gorbachev began the economic reforms and expansion of democracy which Sakharov had predicted, Sakharov was made chief advisor to Gorbachev and a spokesman on Perestroika. You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. Actively promoted Perestroika to Western leaders, the media, the elite, and the general public. He gave briefings on Gorbachev and Perestroika to the British Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher, and to other Western policymakers, advising them to trust and support Perestroika. He extended similar advice to President Mitterrand during his visit to France, and Sakharov acted almost as a national security advisor to President Ronald Reagan, advising him to abandon the Strategic Defense Initiative and also the NATO doctrine of reserving the right to make first use of nuclear weapons. In November 1993, the Russian military specifically asserted precisely this right. Significantly, Sakharov tried to conceal the existence of the Soviet strategy when he stated before an audience of American specialists on Soviet affairs that Gorbachev does not have a unified plan for change. More likely, what he does have is an improvisation. This statement was a deliberate misrepresentation of the strategic challenge which the West is facing. An especially important element in the present Soviet drive to inject their strategic influence into the United States is the recent creation of the International Foundation for the Survival and Development of Humanity, set up during Sakharov's visit to the United States. Sakharov, a leading Soviet agent of influence, is its head. Other members include Velikov, president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and the economist Tatiana Zaslavskaya, who is credited with the reintroduction of the term Perestroika. The foundation is a joint Soviet-American venture for collaboration in research on the environment, pollution, human rights, arms control, and economic development, all of which are relevant to the Soviet strategy of convergence. Zaslavskaya was particularly revealing about the restructuring objectives of the research. She suggested undertaking a study of bureaucracies, which in her words come in different forms in different countries, but are like a social cancer. Such a study would have provided Moscow with valuable detailed information about the United States bureaucracy. Several influential Americans, including the well-known industrialist Mr. Armand Hammer, the associate of Lenin and the president of the Carnegie Foundation of New York, Heimberg, joined the foundation as board members or advisors. The foundation is envisaged as a global work. It has opened offices in Washington and Stockholm, and with a donation from Hammer, has bought a headquarters building in New York. Sakharov's inaugural message was that the West should interact with the Soviet Union, not only because this would reduce the risk of war, but because it would have a civilizing effect on the domestic behavior of the Soviets. This is an obvious scenario for convergence. Prominent Americans with philanthropic interests who joined the foundation are open to manipulation by Sakharov and other Soviet agents of influence because they have complete faith in Sakharov and have no notion of the anti-American designs of Soviet strategy. Listen to me very carefully, ladies and gentlemen. For correct understanding of the strategy and the application of that understanding to the analysis of events enables one to predict otherwise surprising Soviet actions. Since the strategy is long range, as all Soviet strategies have always been, it has several phases. The strategists planned their actions in the early phases in preparation for the final phase. They conceive Soviet reforms in the initial phase. They rehearse them in the preparatory phase, and they introduce them in the final phase. Because of this planning framework, the strategy has its own dialectic. It has its thesis. The Stalinist regime, its antithesis. Criticism and rejection of the Stalinist regime and its synthesis, a new reformed model which Perestroika is designed to create and which will be the product of convergence, the joining of the two opposites. Understanding the dialectic and logic of the strategy is crucial for prediction. It enables one to see how the situation in one phase will develop in the next phase. My personal understanding of the way this works has enabled me to make some astounding predictions over the years, almost all of which have turned out to be 100% accurate. For instance, it enables one to predict the change in the role and status of Soviet dissidents. In the initial phase, they were recruited and trained by the KGB. In the preparatory phase, they were criticized and persecuted by the KGB. In the final phase, they are accepted and even incorporated into Perestroika. It was through understanding this dialectic that Anatoly Golitsyn was able to predict the simple fact that Sakharov might be included in some capacity in government. In the event, he became one of Gorbachev's chief advisors. It's this same understanding, ladies and gentlemen, which has enabled me to be able to predict the fall of the Iron Curtain, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and a lot of other things that many of you have heard me tell you would happen, and predictions that I made in my book, Behold a Pale Horse, which have all come to pass. Likewise, the dialectic enables one to understand that Euro-communist criticism in the 1960s and 1970s of repressive practices and violations of human rights in the USSR was undertaken and tolerated with official foreknowledge of the impending reform of the Soviet system. The fact that the Berlin Wall was built at the time when the strategy was adopted was a sufficient basis for the prediction that it would be pulled down again in the strategy's final phase. The dialectic enables one to see, through the calculated publication of anti-Soviet manuscripts abroad, Soviet condemnation of them at the time, and the present lifting of the ban on much of the dissident writing of the 1960s and 1970s. Understanding of the dialectic enables one to provide further predictions and warnings about political and social issues which the Soviet strategists will seek to exploit in Western Europe, the United States, and elsewhere.
Arising, open all the ponds. For reasoning revolves of land, and love sends the age of chance. Now away with all superstition, some message arise, arise. We'll change for Christy all condition, and turn the dust to win the prize. Then comrades, come rally, and the last five let us chase. The International unites the human race. Then comrades, come rally, and the last five let us chase. Chains of hatred, of greed and fear. Ever thieves will disgorge their booty, and to all give a happier lot. Each has his fortune to his duty, and strike the iron when it's hot. Then comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The International unites the human race. And comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face.
The Soviets will proceed with perestroika on the following lines. A mixed socialist market economy comparable to the Swedish economy will be established with one crucial difference. Soviet capitalists will in fact be secret party members and party political tools. Their influence will be used in the interests of the strategy abroad. This is what Soviet maturity means. The party will create controlled plurality and a semblance of social democracy in the USSR. It will not be difficult to do. Even the Stalinist regime in Poland had nominally non-communist independent parties. In fact, they were puppet parties. As a mature body, the Soviet parliament will play an active role in the execution of the strategy abroad. The new parliament will be closer to the Swedish model, again with one difference. It will use its contacts with Western colleagues to influence them towards cooperation and restructuring in the West. The Soviet Empire will not crumble as a result of nationalist unrest. The party will create a stronger federation, which will be in full control of foreign policy, defense, and security, but which will provide autonomy to the national republics to run their own local affairs. As the party proceeds with successful perestroika in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, both Russians and non-Russians will be increasingly inclined to accept it and take part in the process. In the final analysis, their attitude will depend on Western support for Soviet perestroika and the improvement in their way of life. Successful Soviet perestroika will result in a Soviet regime of pseudo-social democracy with a human face. At this juncture, the party and the successor to the KGB will do their utmost to exploit the image of their new model, their prestige, and the contacts and influence of the new parliament, the national fronts, the political groups and parties, and the Soviet capitalists to carry out the intended strategy of restructuring in the West. A consistent effort will be made to expand and deepen restructuring in Eastern Europe and China. The new models will be like Soviet perestroika in essence, but will reflect the specific national and historical features of each country. For instance, in Poland, the model will include communist power sharing with Solidarity and the Catholic hierarchy. In Czechoslovakia, the model will include the experience of 1968. In Hungary, the rehabilitation of the revolt of 1956. In East Germany, the desire for reunion with West Germany, which indeed took place, and in China, it will reflect the Asian character of socialism, the desire for reunion with Taiwan, and the present close relations with the United States. Polish and East German restructuring should be particularly closely watched because of their relevance to the restructuring of Western Europe. Perestroika in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and Eastern Europe will be accompanied by a determined Soviet political and diplomatic offensive to introduce restructuring in Western Europe. Gorbachev and East European leaders will try to develop the present détente into close economic, military, political, cultural, and scientific cooperation to create one Europe without NATO and the Warsaw Pact. A particular effort will be made to develop close relations and cooperation with East European Social Democrats and the Labour Party in Britain. Remember Tony Blair? Exploiting the new Soviet pseudo-social democratic mixed economy image. Attracted by this image and convinced of its authenticity, the Social Democrats may well respond favorably to this courting, as well they did. East Germany will play a crucial role in the restructuring of Western Europe, and of West Germany in particular. The appointment of Valentin Fallon, a leading Soviet expert on Germany, as head of the Central Committee's Department of International Relations, indicates that the Soviets are preparing and counting on an East German initiative. Such an initiative will probably be supported by Polish démarche, such as revival of the Rapaki plan for a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. This time, one can expect the Soviets to remove the Berlin Wall, and they did. There is no doubt that their strategists realize that they will be unable to proceed with the strategy of restructuring in Europe without removal of the Berlin Wall, just as they were unable to proceed without a Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, etc., etc., etc. Now let's cut to the chase. The Soviets will exploit the image of the reformed and peaceful Soviet systems to shatter the Western consensus about the Soviet threat and the need for political and military alliances. In Europe, the Soviets will probably attempt to create a serious rift in NATO, or break it up altogether by removing the Berlin Wall and reaching a Rapallo-style deal with West Germany involving West Germany's withdrawal from NATO and following Austria into neutrality. In fact, what happened, ladies and gentlemen, is that they are moving Eastern Bloc nations to become members of NATO. In Asia, the Soviets may attempt to break up the U.S.-Japan Security Pact by returning the Kuril Islands to Japan and offering Japan economic concessions to promote the development of Siberia. You can see this as being proposed as an answer to the current economic problems in Japan, and that comes from William Cooper, ladies and gentlemen. As the Soviets carry out restructuring in the Third World, they will use their influence to reduce the American presence in the region. That has already taken place. The Soviets will do their utmost to persuade any new administration in the United States to follow Reagan's policy of embracing perestroika and rapprochement with the Soviet Union. They will intensify the efforts of Mikhail Gorbachev and Sakharov to engage the American elite in cooperation over the environment, space, disarmament, and the joint solution of social, political, economic, environmental, military, and international problems, and all of these have taken place. Visits by Soviet scientists, politicians, intellectuals, and cultural delegations will be stepped up in order to put across to the Americans the ideas of restructuring and convergence. Likewise, more American scientists, intellectuals, opinion formers, politicians, and religious groups will be invited to the USSR, where they will be subjected to persuasion on the advantages of restructuring and convergence, all of which has occurred. Soviet agents of influence in the United States will redouble their attempts to act as catalysts in promoting restructuring and convergence. They will initiate public debates on security aimed at shattering the American consensus on the Soviet threat and destabilizing and restructuring the United States military-industrial complex. It has been accomplished. KGB agents among Soviet dissidents and cultural defectors will travel back and forth between the United States and the USSR, acting as, and where have you heard this before? Bridge builders in cultural and political convergence. The whole political potential of the KGB-controlled political parties and so-called grassroots organizations will be used to establish links with their genuine counterparts in the United States and influence them towards restructuring. During their visits to the United States, they will try to impress the Americans with the growing similarity of their system to the American system and to convince them of the soundness of convergence as a means of avoiding nuclear war. As structuring proceeds in Eastern Europe, the East Europeans will join the Soviet offensive to gain a foothold in the United States and to secure their share of political influence over the American ethnic minorities. All has been accomplished. The Soviets, their allies, and KGB agents of influence will conduct a campaign of political and ideological warfare against anti-communism and the political influence of anti-communists in the West. It will project Soviet perestroika as a fundamental change in the Soviet system, as a dissolution of communist ideology, as a reduction in the Soviet threat, and as an end of the Cold War. All has been accomplished. Georgi Arbatov described the process as the removal of the Soviet enemy from the minds of the Americans. The Soviet media, the Soviets' allies and agents of influence will attack and seek to isolate anti-communism and anti-communists as obstacles to restructuring, cold warriors, and enemies of peace. The targets of the assault will be the political leaders and government officials who have a realistic understanding of the Soviet threat, anti-communists in the Republican and Democratic parties, especially those on the political and religious right, anti-communists in the socialist, social democratic, and conservative parties in Western Europe, American and European experts on Soviet affairs, and members of the American and European media who are trying to be objective in presenting perestroika and its meaning for the democracies. They will be attacked as reactionaries, bureaucrats with outworn ideas, political or religious Cold War warriors, spoilers, or just fascists. How many times have you heard that word used? The attack will aim to neutralize them by ridicule and to turn them into an endangered species. This has been accomplished. An article in the New York Times of 19 September 1988 by Stephen Cohen an American expert on Soviet affairs, and perestroika in particular, gives one an idea of what may be expected. Mr. Cohen writes that the centrists lack the guts to respond to Gorbachev. For this reason, he gives the new president disturbing advice: to appoint to all relevant foreign policy positions only people deeply committed to the anti-Cold War effort. The Soviet Yakovlevs and Arbatovs can be expected to accelerate the neutralization and removal from Western political life of anti-communists through new, calculated projections of Soviet and East European developments. For example, they may attack in the press and remove from office their own conservatives as enemies of perestroika. They did that. The recent demotion of Ligachev may be seen in this light. The Soviets may use the creation of party-controlled independent national organizations in the Baltic states to influence American anti-communists from the captive nations toward the acceptance of perestroika and a reversal of their anti-communist attitudes. And listen to this very carefully. The KGB and its Department of Political Assassinations may be expected to take part in this final battle and to carry out assassinations of prominent anti-communists who are regarded as serious obstacles to the strategy of restructuring in the West. These assassinations will be conducted skillfully and will be unattributable to the KGB, as was the assassination of Stepan Bandera, the anti-communist Ukrainian nationalist leader in 1959, until the defection of his assassin. In Anatoly Golitsyn's opinion, the assassination of South Korean leaders in Burma, though carried out by the North Koreans, would not have been decided upon by the North Korean leaders on their own, but would have had the blessing of both Moscow and Peking. The recent deaths of the Pakistani president, General Zia, and of a leading West German banker and anti-communist should be re-examined in this light as possible components of the KGB's destabilization program. The Soviets' strategic interest in the assassination of their serious political enemies will render unrealistic American expectations of genuine, wholehearted Soviet-American cooperation against international terrorism.
Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rain's gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? What did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown.
the principal objective of the attack on anti-communists in the West is to influence the outcome of the forthcoming national elections in the United States and Western Europe. The Soviet strategists relate their chances of successful execution of their strategy of restructuring to victories of the left in these elections. They believe that the conditions are favorable. In their assessment, the intelligence services of the United States, Britain, France, and West Germany have been seriously weakened. They have lost their capabilities. They have lost, listen to me carefully, they have lost their capabilities through public exposure or through deep KGB penetration. They have been misinformed about Soviet strategic intentions toward the West. Their ignorance about Soviet strategy has reached such depths that some of the services, the British, for example, unofficially support and promote Gorbachev and Soviet perestroika. For these reasons, the Soviet strategists regard the Western services as paper tigers and discount them as a serious obstacle to their strategy in the West. In their view, serious resistance to their strategy of restructuring can come only from their ideological enemies, the anti-communist conservatives in the United States and Western Europe. They see that conservative leaders, ex-President Reagan, British Prime Minister Thatcher, and West German Chancellor Kohl, have failed to understand the essence of perestroika, have led their supporters in the wrong direction, and have led them into a crisis by their support for Gorbachev. Conservatives are confused about Gorbachev and perestroika. The old assumptions have been upset. They are out of ideas. They have lost perspective. The Soviet strategists, however, are concerned that the conservative crises and confusion are temporary affairs. They believe the conservatives may recover and resist restructuring. For this reason, strategic objectives of Soviet political warfare include, listen to me very carefully, this may be the most important broadcast that you will ever hear. Listen to me very carefully. First of all, the neutralization of anti-communist influence, especially the conservative parties, as an important factor in the political life of the United States, West Germany, France, and Britain. Secondly, securing the victory of the radical left in the next presidential elections in 1992 in the United States and the victory of the Socialist and Labor parties in the nations in the national elections in West Germany, France, and Britain in the 1990s. All of this has happened. We elected a communist as President of the United States of America. His name is William Jefferson Clinton. In England, Tony Blair. France, same thing. Socialist and Labour parties have been victorious. The same thing in the United Germany. The Soviets, and remember, all this was written long before this happened. The Soviets planned to hold the International Conference on Human Rights in Moscow in 1991, and their keen interest in American participation in it is due to their desire to influence the outcome of the elections in favor of the radical left. In their assessment, the left will be prepared to carry out and accelerate restructuring in the United States, and that is exactly what they are doing, practicing convergence with the Soviet Union. The Soviet strategists believe that an economic depression, listen to me very carefully, because I've told you this is coming. I've been telling you for years this is their strategy and this is their plan. The Soviet strategists believe that an economic depression in the United States would provide even more favorable conditions for the execution of their strategy. In that event, the Soviets and their allies would shift to the doctrine of class struggle and try to divide the Western nations along crude class lines. Remember, I told you this global economic collapse is engineered? It is not an accident. The final period of restructuring in the United States and Western Europe would be accompanied not only by the physical extermination, listen to me carefully, the final period of restructuring in the United States and Western Europe would be accompanied not only by the physical extermination of active anti-communists, but also by the extermination of the political, military, financial, and religious elites. I've told you before that this would happen. Blood would be spilled, and political re-education camps would be introduced. The communists would not hesitate to repeat the mass repressions of their revolution in 1917, of the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe in the Second World War, or of the Chinese communist victory of 1949. This time, they would resort to mass repressions in order to prevent any possibility of revolt by the defeated and to make their victory final. The author, Anatoly Golitsyn, bases this conclusion in part on the following information. While the long-range strategy was being formulated in the late 1950s, the Soviet strategists asked for a KGB estimate of the number of West Germans who would need to be isolated in order to turn West Germany into a neutral country. The KGB estimate was 150,000 Germans at that time. Communist China, ladies and gentlemen, and this is going to explain to you what has been happening between the Democratic Party, President William Jefferson Clinton, and the Communist Chinese. You see, Communist China is not a strategic partner, but a concealed strategic enemy of the United States. China will join in the Soviet offensive to bring about restructuring in the United States and worldwide. Through penetration, Chinese communist intelligence destroyed the CIA's sources in China during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, and prevented the agency developing reliable sources on the strategic intentions of the Chinese leaders. The National Security Agency cannot help because information on secret Sino-Soviet strategic coordination is not carried on accessible communications channels. This situation leaves American policymakers poorly informed on the subject. American policymakers from the time of Nixon and Kissinger to the present day have become known for their excessive reliance on the verbal assurances of Mao, Chou En-lai, and Deng. Reliance on their word is no substitute for good intelligence. Because of this intelligence gap, America's policymakers have not distinguished between China's tactics and her strategy. This failure is not new. It was evident as early as the Second World War, when the Americans failed to realize that the Chinese communist cooperation with the nationalists against the Japanese was a tactic adopted in order to achieve their strategic objective, their victory over the nationalists. Some of the statements of the Chinese leaders to their own followers are unflattering about American policymakers and are, in fact, disturbing. In the late 1960s, Mao advised the party not to take the Americans seriously in a strategic, but only in a tactical sense. Deng's well-known statement about a cat catching a mouse, made when China was introducing capitalism and receiving American technology, can be interpreted as meaning that the Chinese communist leader is the cat that caught the American mouse. Because of their confusion, American policymakers believe that Communist China is an important strategic partner and a strategic rival and enemy of the Soviet Union. In this, they are wrong. China is a tactical, not a strategic partner of the United States, and a tactical, but not a strategic enemy of the Soviet Union. And the grounds for this conclusion are to be found by analyzing the long-range communist strategy which illuminates the strategic role of China. Communist China was one of the principal architects of the communist long-range strategy. The Sino-Soviet split was a common strategic disinformation operation to secure the successful preparation of their common strategy of restructuring. the Soviet and Chinese leaders have continued their secret strategic coordination through a division of labor. Gorbachev's perestroika and Deng's four modernizations, a Chinese euphemism for restructuring or perestroika, are two similar elements in the final phase of the common strategy. In the light of the new method of analysis, the purpose of Shevardnadze's hastily arranged trip to China on the eve of President Bush's visit was to give advice to Deng on his talks with the American president. Gorbachev and Deng will use their meeting to discuss coordination and new initiatives to be taken during the final phase of the strategy. The new analysis sees the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan as a tactical move en route to the principal strategic objective, restructuring, by engaging the United States in support of perestroika. China's close relations with the United States and even Chinese helpfulness to the United States over the Pakistan-Afghanistan situation are tactics intended to secure China's primary strategic objective of becoming a modern superpower with the help, listen to me very carefully, with the help of American technology. According to this analysis, the Chinese leaders are using their own party apparatus and security services to try to repeat Soviet success in creating controlled political opposition and introducing its members to the United States in order to shape American policy in the interests of a common communist strategy. In fact, the Chinese have been so impressed by Sakharov's success in gaining influence in the United States that they are developing their own Sakharovs, agents of influence among leading Chinese dissident scientists. Thus, it can be predicted that the Chinese will establish their own foothold of influence in the United States and will eventually join the Soviet offensive to procure American restructuring. For China is destined to become a primary Soviet partner in the future world government towards which Moscow and Peking are jointly proceeding.
Never in human history has so few taken so much from so many as America's Illuminati and their warlords of Wall Street and Washington. In just 8 years, these banksters and international government gangsters took us from the greatest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation on Earth. Our standard of living has dropped like a rock for 4 out of every 5 Americans. They have foreclosed on our homes, our farms, our factories. They've exported your jobs and surrendered our arms.
They want a new world order. A new world order. A new world order. A new world order.
The Illuminati wants you to be a slave from birth to grave. The banksters own the Federal Reserve. It's private. They own it. It's neither federal nor a reserve. The cashists make that fiat funny money stuff you call dollar for 2 pennies. They lend it back to us.
Ladies and gentlemen, in case you believe that there is no connection between the Illuminati and the communist world, global socialism, if you will, remember this. the Soviet Union was the ultimate realization of the Illuminati's dream of the apotheosis of mankind. It was a great experiment. The thesis lined up against the antithesis will result in a synthesis, whatever the outcome of the clash between the two, will be the New World Order. And I'm telling you right now, it will be a totalitarian, socialist, utopian world. Utopian only for those whose dreams will be realized. Not for those of us who love liberty and freedom above all else. We will continue with this tomorrow night. My throat's just about given out, folks, and if I don't stop right now, I'm not going to have a throat for tomorrow night. So, we have 4 gold coins that have been donated to us for the television project. Listen to me very carefully. We have one 1895 MS-63 coronet $20 gold piece. It is rated MS-63 by NGCA. 1895, $20 gold piece, MS-63. It's enclosed in the plastic case, rated MS-63 by NGCA. Or NGCS, I'm not sure exactly because there's a label over this. But it's got the little balance of scales there. Coin World, the trends section of Coin World values this coin at $825. Call me tomorrow between noon and 4 p.m. Make a reasonable offer, and the coin is yours. A reasonable offer. I'm holding in my hand now a 1908 $20 St. Gaudens $20 gold piece, rated MS, or I should say graded MS-64. Same grading organization. Trends, Coin World Trends, values this coin at $775. Same thing. Call me tomorrow between noon and 4 p.m. Make a reasonable offer and the coin is yours. Here's a 1924 MS-64, graded MS-64, St. Gaudens, $20 gold piece. Coin World Trends rates it at $775, same thing. 1924, $20 St. Gaudens, graded MS-64. Coin World Trends rates it at $775. Call me tomorrow between noon and 4 p.m. Make a reasonable offer upon whichever one of these 4 coins you wish to have as a donation toward the television project, and it's yours. Simple as that. So we got time for maybe 3 calls, 2 or 3, and maybe even 4 calls. So I'm going to open the lines right now, 520-333-4578. Somebody please call and help me out and talk for the rest of this broadcast so I will be able to talk again tomorrow. I'm almost well. In fact, I really feel well, except my voice has not fully returned. The number is 520-333-4578. Give me a hand. Somebody call up and talk for 5 minutes. Or somebody call and talk for 2 minutes. And then let somebody else call and talk for 2 minutes or 1 minute or whatever, about whatever you wish for the remaining few minutes of this broadcast. Once again, the source material for tonight's broadcast was the Perestroika. See, I can't even talk anymore. The Perestroika Deception by Anatoly Golitsyn, one of the highest ranked Soviet defectors to the United States who defected in December of 1961. Once again, the number is 520-333-4578. It's toward the end of the last hour. I would just about bet that Voice of America has cranked up its transmitter, and we're probably not getting out anymore. So, in that case, since we're not getting any calls, what I'm going to do is just play music for the rest of the broadcast, and you'll get to hear a little bit of what 101, well, we did get a call, by golly. Let's see what's going on here. Good evening, you're on the air.
Cooper, you sound real good in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Well, thank you. That's great.
You come in clear. I just got in from work, and I just missed your program. I just turned it on.
Well, that's too bad, because this was
a... I'll try to listen to it tomorrow, because it sounds like you're going to have a good program tomorrow.
Well, this was a very important broadcast tonight. Tomorrow night will be also. Oh, good.
You're perfect.
That's wonderful.
I'll enjoy listening to you tomorrow, and thank you very much.
How's your weather there?
We're going to be 60 degrees tomorrow.
You have overcast or clear or what?
Yeah, it's clear.
Wow.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 60 degrees tomorrow, 60 degrees, and nice all week.
Our weather report said snow all day today and tomorrow, and it's been clear and sunny with not a cloud in the sky. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, yeah, but we were lucky. That's about it on that. We got some strange weather.
Well, yes, we do. But I think in the next issue of Veritas, some of that might be explained.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be listening to you tomorrow.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye.
520-333-4578. If anybody else wants to call before I... get to some music here, because I just really don't want to talk anymore. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hello, William. This is Clarence from North Carolina.
Hi, Clarence.
I've been listening to your show all night. I've got the book by Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika, what you've been saying is right in line with his book.
Yeah, he just admits it in there, doesn't he?
Yeah, I've got a few little selected quotes.
Go ahead.
There are different interpretations of perestroika in the West, including the United States. There is a view that it has been necessitated by the disastrous state of the Soviet economy and that it signifies disenchantment with socialism and a crisis for its ideals and ultimate goals. Nothing could be further from the truth than such interpretations, whatever the motives behind them.
And of course, folks, Mikhail Gorbachev wrote that.
Right. I have one more little section here. Perestroika is closely connected with socialism as a system. To put an end to all the rumors and speculations that abound in the West about this, I would like to point out once again that we are conducting all our reforms in accordance with the socialist choice. We are looking within socialism rather than outside it for the answers to all the questions that arise. We assess our successes and errors alike by socialist standards. Those who hope that we shall move away from the socialist path will be greatly disappointed. Every part of our program of perestroika, and the program as a whole, for that matter, is fully based on the principle of more socialism and more democracy.
That's right. And, of course, V.I. Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, who founded the Soviet Union, you heard him, he was one of the speakers that I played tonight, said, democracy is indispensable to socialism.
Right, and the terms are used interchangeably.
Yes, and Karl Marx said democracy is the road to socialism. Both Lenin and Marx said the goal of socialism is communism. So don't be fooled, folks, by all this democratization.
What's interesting about this book, I bought it at a used bookstore, and it's got written in here, purchased during Summit Fever in May-June 1988. Read approximately half of book before Summit occurred, took book with me to TBS, and then finished it during the special. Social Party Conference of late June 1988. So it appears from reading this that a communist might have owned this book.
That could be true.
It's got a signature, but you can't read it. It starts with a D and ends, looks like, with an F.
Yeah.
That's somewhat interesting, you know, to figure out that it probably was one of these leftists, as we say.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for calling and helping me out. It's time to go.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All of you out there, get the book called New Lies for Old by Anatoly Golitsyn. Read it first. Then get the Perestroika Deception by Anatoly Golitsyn. Read it second. Then get Perestroika by Mikhail Gorbachev and read it. And then wake your butts up before it's too damn late to wake up.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, there's a loud knock on your door. Hey, honey. Something's not right.
Throw out your arms. Let the Templar pass through. We're here for the government. We're here to help you.
And I'm from the IRS with a power to tax. Did you got a complaint?
Get out of this house. Surrender your guns. Give me your gold. You better obey if you want to go home. Now to the doorstep and do what you're told.
Hillary Salala, Reno Janet Dyke, reading the words of General Albert Pike. Demonic founder of the Ku Klux Klan, engineer of the Masonic Master Plan. Pike said Lucifer is God across this land. And Clinton saying take the mark in your right hand. While we're all dancing to the drums of uproar, right? Clinton's preparing it for another huge tax hike. Order out of chaos, depression, inflation, creates a panic and rape the nation. Order. Crisis creation. Incite black and white. Program agitation.
Don't resist. You're surrounded by the UN in white and blue, the ATF, the men in black, from the One World Order.
But it's not new. Iron Mountain, computer beasts, and cattle mutilations. Black projects, UFOs, and weird genetic combinations. The Nazi doctors didn't die. Come on, get him. They came here with the OSS through Operation Paperclip. National ID, debit card? Yeah. Vaccination, biochip, milk carton kits, genetic engineering. Clinton says her health plans for you and your own good. Sure. And Adolf Hitler's Robin Hood. Masonic mind manipulation. Inciting riots is crisis creation. Biochip implantation. Vaccinate your kid for UN identification.
This is a test for all of us. So I have today just one simple request. A comprehensive package of healthcare benefits that are always there and can never be taken away. Never be taken away.
Atmospheric social illusion. Media hype. Planned confusion. Masonic religion. It's a liar. Got you praying for a Luciferian Messiah. Illuminati thinks that they're enlightened, that they're to be the gods of Earth, born of incest from the sons of Satan and their sisters in satanic birth.
Hidden Agenda, Kissinger, Nixon, Ford, and Bill. While your kid's out back smoking crack for some cheap thrill. They've numbed us down and dumbed us down with fluoride, TV, drugs, the NEA, and public schools. They've taken your brightest and our best and made them public schools. With managed media, brain-bending lies and filth, the banksters stole your wealth. Johnson, Bush, Carter, Reagan, Gore, and Dan, they've all been pushing pipes, but my master plan. Rhodes Scholar Oration. Clinton speaks, then rapes the nation. Luciferian Subjugation. New World Order Illuminati Coronation.
Maps, Media, Grand Ovation.
Orders of the Quest. Think they're superior, they think that they're the best.
And you're inferior, you little pet.
Skull and Bones, Colon T, Knight Templar, Harvard University.
They're the Faustian Fraternity.
Knights of the Golden Circle, Ancient Order of the Rosen Cross, CFR Albatross.
Party, Rockefeller's Bomb.
MK Ultra, ISA, from the OSS to the CIA.
Mass murder is the game they play.
Galileo, NASA, Jupiter, plutonium is out.
Dual sun. They'll call it Lucifer for fun.
Pyramid Giza, Hitler called it the Luciferian Millennium.
1,000 points of light.
Love of Rome, Thunderdome, Isis, Horus, Lucifer, Christ. If the U.S. lives, y'all go back.
Wake up, stupid, read the scoop. Mullen, sudden, driven, and tune in to Coop.
Come on, final teaser.
Bohemian Grove, Beverly Hall, Lord Betrayer, they want it all.
Yeah, they want it all.
Kissinger, Gingrich, Army, Buckley, Dole, New World Order, authoritarian control.
Counterfeit. That's
ladies and gentlemen, the graduated income tax administered by the Internal Revenue Service is the second plank of Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto. Good night, and God bless you all.